ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
The woman Wu, who has falsely usurped the throne, is by nature obdurate and unyielding. Her heart is like a serpent and her nature is like a wolf. Gods and men have cast her out. Heaven and earth have no room for her.
She went from being a concubine to being the only female emperor in what we now call China in 4,000 years.
She is the woman who is responsible for turning China into the largest Buddhist nation in the world.
And yet her story remains a mystery for most.
It's a major moment in world history, and we just don't know it in the West.
I'm Mark Fennell, and over 1,000 years ago, one woman defied the age she lived in. She shifted the beliefs of billions and ruled an empire. And I promise you, no one saw it coming. I want you to imagine that we're in the 7th century in a land that we now call China. And I'm going to introduce you to somebody, a young girl by the name of Wu Zetian.
Her dad is actually a wood merchant, a timber merchant, who is regarded by the Confucian hierarchy, I think, as sort of nouveau riche and vulgar. But her mum is from this posh old world. And they get to give their daughter, who is clearly from a very early age recognised to be an extraordinary beauty, into the emperor's harem, age 15. Now, of course, that seems horrific and child abuse. But at the time, in every country in the world, 15 is a marriageable age, not just in China.
This, by the way, is William Dalrymple.
I am a historian. I write about India and I live between India and London, but I'm originally a Scot. And she finds herself, age 15, in the emperor's harem. And this is recognized, as in all courtly cultures, as a great asset for the family, because obviously if the girl does well and comes to favor and effectively triumphs over her rivals, the family stands to gain and get perks at court as she rises up the hierarchy.
And does it work? Like, does she fall into favor?
It does work. She's initially basically, I think, in charge of the laundry. I mean, she comes in very junior, age 15. And at this stage, the Tang Emperor, Taizong, is very old, but clearly not so old as to be beyond having a harem. And we don't know any of the details of her relationship with Taizong. It's usually presumed that she must have slept with him, but it's not absolutely certain that she did. What is clear is that as the old man gets into his dotage, the crown prince, who's called Gaizong, moves into his chambers to help nurse him. And at that point, she definitely connects herself to the crown prince.
So we have the concubine who has already caught the attention of the emperor and his son, the crown prince. But weirdly, one of the most important characters in this saga is not a royal, but in fact, a monk, a Buddhist monk named Xuanzang.
He is one of the most important figures in Buddhist history. He's a kind of nerdy scholar who decides in his probably early 20s that he has to walk to India at a time when the old dynasty is going down and the new dynasty is coming up, when the whole place is in chaos. This lone, unarmed monk heads off into first the Gobi, then the Taklamakan Desert, very nearly kills himself. And eventually, Xuanzang makes it safely to Nalanda, which is a name that will not be particularly familiar to Australian readers and listeners, but should be, because Nalanda is basically the Library of Alexandria for Asia. It's both a university, a research facility, and a monastery. And it has a 9-story tall library that is the greatest in the world at the time. And people come not just from China, like Xuanzang, but from Japan, from Korea, from Indonesia. The whole Buddhist world recognizes Nalanda as the Oxbridge, the NASA, the Ivy League of its day. And Xuanzang spends 20 years at Nalanda copying out manuscripts.
After a measly 2 decades of writing, this monk heads back to China with bundles of transcripts. And when he gets back, he learns that the emperor is on his deathbed.
Xuanzang is at his pillow, trying to convert him to Buddhism, but telling him also about his travels. Taizong has ordered a copy of the London Library to be built in Xi'an, then known as Chang'an, which is still there. It's called the Wild Goose Pagoda. You can go and see it. And Wu Zetian and Xuanzang become kind of allies because they're both Buddhists and they're both ambitious for Buddhism, but for completely different reasons. Xuanzang is obviously a holy old monk, but he is very ambitious for Buddhism, which is an outsider religion in China.
At this particular moment in time, the two dominant religions, or philosophies really, in China are Confucianism, so very hierarchical, very virtuous, very rigid. And then on the other side, you have Taoism, which was much more about living in harmony and balance with the universe.
Now, Buddhism, at this point, is seen as a foreign religion, something from India. And the Taoists and Confucians are very against it.
So the young concubine, Wu Zetian, and that Buddhist monk, they are trying to convert the emperor and his Chinese court to Buddhism. The problem is, the emperor dies.
So this is a catastrophe for both the old monk and the young concubine. Both of them, who were on the verge of seeing this amazing change of power, do not get what they want. And Wu, aged now presumably 16 or 16 and a half, has to change from the robes, silken robes of the concubine in the royal palace to the Hessian sackcloth of a nun, and is banished with all the other women of the court to a nunnery, which is the normal Chinese thing that happens when an emperor dies. And she gets shunted out.
But all is not lost, because the new emperor and Wu Zetian, they know each other. Gaizong is his name. He's the son of the old emperor who used Wu Zetian as a concubine and, of course, has recently died. And according to some accounts, Wu Zetian and Gaizong, they had eyes for each other even when his father was still alive, which I think it's safe to say was fairly taboo.
Now, it seems that Gaizong must have slept with Wu Zetian before the old man is dead. Or if they didn't actually sleep together, he'd certainly fallen for her. Because the story goes that a year after his father's death, he comes to visit the women of the court, now wearing sackcloth and ashes and living in a nunnery, very different world to what they had been used to. And at this point, Wu Zetian passes on this passionate poem saying, basically, "I've always loved you. Call me back, sir. I'm waiting for you." And it works. Now, Gaizong at this point has not only a wife, but a chief concubine and the whole other setup that you'd expect. And Wu Zetian, over the next 6 months to a year, manages to implicate both the chief concubine and the empress as witches.
Sorry, and, what? how do you imply somebody's a witch?
So we should say up front here that Wu Zetian is already locked in battle with the Confucians of the court.
Mm.
When she dies, 50 years forward from now...
Spoiler alert.
The Confucians... Yeah, she does die eventually. It happens.
Yeah.
When she dies, 50 years later, the Confucians come back into power and do all they can to blacken her name. And we actually have a description of her written by one of the Confucian hierarchy.
So this is her enemies rewriting her
history. So this is all a big proviso, saying that we don't actually know, from her perspective, what happened. All we've got is her enemies' accounts, which give this incredibly bloodthirsty account. So this is what they think of her. "The woman Wu, who has falsely usurped the throne, is by nature obdurate and unyielding, by origins truly obscure. Formerly, she served Taizong with her body. Then she made use of occasion when Gaizong was changing his clothes to commit fornication with him. Later, she brought disturbance to the palace, concealing her intimacy with the late emperor, and secretly contrived to become the favorite of the sovereign. She plotted the ruin of the original empress, the Lady Wang, and entrapped our emperor into incest. She slew her sister, murdered her brother, assassinated her lord, and poisoned her own mother. Her heart is like a serpent, and her nature is like a wolf. Gods and men have cast her out. Heaven and earth have no room for her.
Brutal. But to recap where we are in the story, you've got Wu Zetian. She has escaped the nunnery. Thanks to the new emperor, she's back in court. And this, in and of itself, is an incredibly rare thing to happen. But she's not done yet. In fact, her campaign for real power has just begun.
So all this has to come with that health warning that this is all we know about this comes from her enemies. And they clearly hate her guts and are trying to blacken her name in every way possible. So it could all be true. We just don't know. But we know that she basically gets her way in the end and seizes power. How she does this, according to her enemies, is that she gets pregnant with the emperor, has a baby, and then, and this sounds entirely implausible and it may well not be true, but this is the account that we have, that she manages to frame the empress with the murder of her child, her infant child. That she, according to her enemies, smothers her own baby with a pillow and blames it on the empress. And then she manages somehow also to implicate the chief concubine, who she accuses, together with the empress, of witchcraft, and that this is a murder that's taken place through witchcraft. Now, Gaizong is obviously sufficiently besotted with her that he apparently goes along with this. And both the empress, who's from a very senior imperial family, and the chief concubine, who up to this point had been the apple of his eye, are tortured, have their bones broken, and left to die in a vat of wine.
I feel like that is one of those deaths that sounds a lot more fun than it actually is. And this chief concubine, currently drowning in wine, the story goes is, before she dies, she tells people that she wants to be reincarnated as a cat so she can murder the mouse that Wu will become.
As a result of which, according to these enemy accounts, Wu bans cats from the palace. So
I can see why they turn this into multiple soap operas, by the way. As you describe it, I'm like, this would make a great soap opera.
It would make a great soap opera and spectacular costumes in the way that only those Chinese period dramas can have, like House of Flying Daggers and Crouching Tiger and all the rest of it. Anyway, what unquestionably does happen is that Wu manages to get out of her nunnery, become a concubine, then replace the empress and the chief concubine, who are dispatched in an unpleasant way. Whether the emperor had actually just bored of them and initiated this himself, or whether it was Wu setting the whole thing up, we are not in a position to tell. But she's certainly blamed for it by posterity. And it's also true that she manages to get through a whole court of sort of chief ministers and advisors who are serially dispatched. And a lot of the rival Tang dynasty, who she's about to replace, are also massacred at this time. So she sounds like a pretty bloodthirsty sort, but we don't know the detail of it.
But this isn't just the story of a ruthless, powerful woman. No, this is about the changing beliefs of billions of people over generations here, because she's seizing this power by embracing Buddhism.
This most bloodthirsty of emperors is also this crucial moment in history when China has its court turned Buddhist. It happens for only one generation. And for certainly the early years of her reign, the Taoists and Confucians are kicked out of the hierarchy. The Buddhists are raised above them. And China briefly becomes a Buddhist country. In other words, China takes on an Indian religion. Today, many people listening to this may not associate Buddhism with India at all because, you know, you think of Tibet, you think of distant Far East, China, Japan, Korea. But, of course, Buddhism is an Indian religion and was certainly viewed as such by the Confucians, who, you know, have a horror of all things foreign. But the point is that Wu wanted this not only because she is a Buddhist, but because Buddhism has a much more positive attitude about women.
So Confucius saw women essentially as inferior to men, and he said that they had to be obedient to their father, their husband, their son. And their responsibilities were really bound by the four walls of the house. And that idea, that role, that really permeated society. So you have to ask yourself the question, how on earth would Wu overcome that perception? Well, the answer is by actively promoting Buddhism, because
there's no such strictures in Buddhism. So what Wu does at this point is she builds up, she calls them the scholars of the Northern Gate. And they're important to my story about Indian influence because they are quite largely products of Nalanda University. So these guys get everything set up. And as Gai Zong sickens, he has a stroke, and she becomes regent. And then he gets worse and worse and goes to bed, and she effectively becomes the ruler of the country. Then he dies. Now that, again, should be the moment that she's chucked off for the second time to a nunnery. But no, the scholars of the Northern Gate get everything arranged. And instead of being thrown out into a nunnery, she becomes the only woman emperor in 4,000 years of Chinese dynastic history.
Do you think her faith in Buddhism was real? Or was it something that she recognized could one day protect the legitimacy of her role as emperor? Like how Machiavellian do we think she actually was?
So historians divide on this. And there is a whole world of Chinese feminist history that thinks Wu Zetian is completely innocent and is this sort of model woman emperor who's just got slagged off by a bunch of patriarchal Confucian historians who have done her in. I think she's clearly a tough woman. I mean, there's no question that, and just the way she goes through, for example, chief ministers in the first 25 years of her reign, who are constantly ending up committing suicide or being dispatched to the provinces or having bits of themselves chopped off. She's clearly ruling with an iron rule. Plus, she manages to get the complete support of the Buddhist hierarchy, who produce a whole load of sort of completely bogus, or rather manipulate existing texts, to see Wu Zetian, this concubine, stroke, potential murderous, stroke, baby killer, as the reincarnation of the Bodhisattva Maitreya.
Because she does become regarded as like a deity, doesn't she?
So she rewards all Buddhists who discover prophecies that will cement her place in power. So the top prize goes to a monk who comes up with this. The prophecy of the Devi is that she should rule over the land and the body of a woman. I will send the Devi with rods of gold to punish any arrogant and recalcitrant men that refuse her. She will one day rule one quarter of the realm of the Chakravartin, the all-encompassing emperor. Harvest will be bountiful, joy without limit. The people will flourish, secure from desolation and illness, of worry, of fear, of disaster. So all these monks say she's basically a divine figure. And there's no question that she rules for 50 years, the only woman in the whole of Chinese history who pulls this trick off.
And she's the only one.
Only one.
That's incredible.
And she pulls this off by turning China into a Buddhist land and her kingdom into a Buddhist kingdom. So opening up the world for ambitious Indians who pour into Chang'an and Luoyang, the two capitals, and rise to a peak of influence and power that will never be equated again. No other India, but also no other external power will ever get the same power in the Chinese system as the Indians get at this period.
I love this story. I think this story is incredible. And not just because it shows the linkage between what is now China and India. I also think what's interesting about it is that it forever changes faith, right? Obviously, Confucianism has a long history before and after, but Buddhism, the center of gravity, it shifts in this moment. And Wu Zetian is a crucial character in that.
Absolutely true. This is the moment. There are two things going on. What we've seen here is the rise of Buddhism to power in China, what one historian has called the Buddhist conquest of China. But there's another thing going on that we haven't talked about, which is the decline of Buddhism in India. So when Xuanzang goes to India, he goes to Nalanda and sees this institution at its peak with this extraordinary university monastery at the center of the world's learning. But he's also seeing, and he records in his travel account, monasteries that were flourishing, diminishing. dynasties that were Buddhist are now Hindu. And he sees the beginning of the Hindu revival in India. And there is this odd thing whereby Buddhism, which from the time of the Emperor Ashoka was, you know, the dominant religion at court. It's difficult to tell what's the dominant religion in the countryside. But certainly at court, across the Indian courts, Buddhism has this moment from about 250 BCE to about 600, maybe 800 years in all, when Buddhism is dominant in the courts of India. But pretty soon, it's diminishing and diminishing and diminishing until by the 18th century, I think there's one Buddhist monastery left on the main peninsula of India outside the Himalayas. And at the same time, Buddhism is coming to power in not just China, but across Southeast Asia, Korea, yeah. Japan. So you're right, Buddhism shifts eastwards. And you have this weird thing whereby Buddhism takes over Southeast Asia and East Asia. And you find that previously Hindu monuments like Angkor Wat, which was originally a temple to the god Vishnu, becomes Buddhist. While in India, the opposite happens. You have all these Buddhist shrines that end up Hindu.
Towards the end of her reign, Wu Zetian realizes that time is not on her side. She's getting old and her health is waning. In a period that, I have to be honest with you, is coloured red with so much spilt blood, when Wu Zetian dies, it's actually not from murder. It's old age. She passed away at 81. She held the reins of power for half a century. After her death, though, her son assumes power and starts to unwind the changes that his own mother had made.
The son then reinvites the Confucians, reinvites the Taoists. The Buddhists are not kicked out, but the Buddhists are reduced to the same level as the others. It's no longer a Buddhist kingdom. And the Confucians do all they can to blacken her name at that point. So it's now, from the distance of history, it's impossible to do more than speculate about quite how wicked she was, whether she actually was a baby murderer and a concubine murderer and all the other horrors that we read about. They're terrific stories. Whether they're true or not, we just don't know. But an operator, she clearly was.
This is a strange question that I don't often ask on this show, but because so much of Wu Zetian's story has been told for her.
All of it's been told for her. We have almost nothing of her own words.
What would you like to ask her if she was sitting in front of you?
So there's another side to Wu Zetian that we perhaps should say is there too. She was, you asked, and I didn't quite answer, was she a pious Buddhist? The answer is yes, she was.
Mm.
And you know, it's possible to be a very, very strong and possibly murderous ruler, but also be pious and to see yourself as doing what is necessary for your faith or your people or your family. And I suspect Wu Zetian would have thought that she was just doing what was necessary to safeguard her family, herself, and her religion, the Dharma of the Buddhists. And we have images of her from other accounts of her own reign. For example, sitting with learned scholars, helping them copy out their texts and apprenticing herself, basically, to the great scholars of the end of her reign. She must have been the most terrifying copy editor that any scholar could possibly, any writer could ever have.
The hand shaking.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're saying. But she did literally place herself at the feet of these learned monks. So she put herself out as a pious Buddhist, and there's no reason to think that she wouldn't have seen herself as a very pious Buddhist who had led to the triumph of the Buddhist faith, which was the faith she was brought up in.
And so that is how a concubine ends up becoming the first and only empress of what is now China and shifts Buddhism from India and makes it the dominant religion of Asia.
It's a major moment in world history, and we just don't know it in the West. It's not a story we tell, but it is now an extremely well-known story in China, where you know, this was bigger than House of Flying Daggers, this was bigger than Crouching Tiger and all the rest of it.
William, it has been an absolute pleasure to finally meet you.
Well, I should say, it's a great pleasure. We have been fighting the same battles and ploughing the same furrow for a while now. And so, great pleasure to meet you too.
The pleasure is all mine. We should do something. We should talk about the British Empire at some point.
Exactly. Why are we talking about the Chinese?
Just for something different. Yeah. Thank you so much and really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
William Dalrymple there, the author and historian. His latest book is called The Golden Road, How Ancient China Transformed the world. This episode of No One Saw It Coming was produced by Zoe Ferguson on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia, for ABC Radio National. The sound engineer was Andy Grant. And if you enjoyed this episode, can you just do me a favour? Can you scroll down over some of the other episodes? Because I reckon the episode with Richard Feidler telling me about a volcano that toppled not one, but two empires, I reckon you might be into that. And of course, if you like your stuff the British style, please check out the episode about the butterfly thief. And with that, I shall leave you. Until next week, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.